There's no distance too far for the perfect trip.
Hi, checking in for...
Or the perfect table.
Hey, where are you?
Coming!
And when you get access to Resi Priority Notify with your Amex Platinum card...
Hey, this looks amazing!
I'm so glad you made it.
And travel benefits at fine hotels and resorts booked through Amex Travel. It's worth the trip. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
The Pure Hoops podcast is a presentation of Pure Hoops Media. The Pure Hoops podcast most definitely does reflect the views of our management. Here's three-time NBA champ BJ Armstrong and Eric Newman.
The Pure Hoops Podcast, it is Thursday, October 1st. The Lakers are up 1-0 in the finals over the Heat. And just before we dug in here, BJ, the man I still call coach, the man who still to me is everything about Celtic pride, winning a championship there in 2008. Has now signed with the Philadelphia 76ers to be their next head coach. What do you make of Doc Rivers' exit from the Clippers and immediately Philadelphia, as much as they've screwed things up the last couple of years, this is a heck of a move for the Sixers. What are your immediate thoughts and reaction?
Well, I'm torn and a lot of things get me emotionally involved, but I was a little torn when Doc Rivers was fired from the Clippers. And because I always, you know, try to look at the game objectively and really, you know, I think from a unique standpoint is that, you know, working in the league for so many years is to try to see the game from many different perspectives. From the Clippers' perspective, firing Doc Rivers, I didn't quite understand the move.
I don't understand it at all.
And this is no criticism, but I truly didn't understand the move, right? Doc Rivers is, I think he's a Hall of Famer as a coach. I think he's earned the right to have the opportunity to coach. And what he's done there, and his integrity, what he's done for the game itself,
and that franchise,
and this friend, it just didn't sit well with me on a lot of different levels. And I'm the first to say, you know, hey, you know, coaches are going to get fired, players are going to get traded, and this is the business. But certain things, and this is one of them, just didn't sit right with me at all. You know, I was rooting for Doc, and I have a relationship with Doc, and I hope, because this is very quickly, that this was the move for him, not that he made a decision on an emotional level. You know, what has it only been like 3 or 4 days, and he's already back in the coaching seat. So clearly, he still have the desire to coach and wants to coach. But this just seems very quickly for me. You know, moving forward, because when you coach, you know, it's, you know, your heart has to be there. And not to say that, you know, that's not the case here with him going to Philly. It's just, this just came together so quickly for them with this franchise, with this team, with their personnel and what they have. So I think it's a great hire for Philly because of who Doc is. But things just happened so quickly. And maybe they knew what they had. Maybe they said, hey, we can't pass up an opportunity of whatever's going on to have a Doc Rivers. And I hope Doc, maybe that's how Doc feels. I don't know. I don't dare to even guess. But I just, and you asked me that question, it just didn't sit well with me with the Clippers. But I'm wishing the best for Doc. I think it's a great hire. But I always look at the players. I always look at the talent. And I look at their two best players. I look at Ben Simmons, who is, without question, he's a top 10 talent. Without question. Joel Embiid, he's a top 10 talent. But no one yet has been able to get those two to play at the level that we all, you know, placed upon them. And now it falls in the, you know, on the shoulders of Doc Rivers. And if anyone can do it, I know he's more than capable. So I'm rooting for him. And I just hope that, you know, when you look at this roster and you look at, you know, what they've done, they've certainly underachieved thus far, the Sixers. And hopefully they'll get it together. Hopefully Doc will put it together and put the right pieces in place, because clearly they have the talent to do it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you look at the last 2 years, the Sixers have been a drastically different team when you have Jimmy Butler and J.J. Redick with Ben Simmons and Joel Embiid compared to last season where they're gone and, you know, Al Horford in, Josh Richardson in. And obviously that combination does not work. And then you've got Tobias Harris there as well, who we know is a very talented player, but he's also comes with a hefty contract. So they're in a rough spot with how do they upgrade their roster or make the necessary moves to help Simmons and Embiid excel. Obviously, Doc's been in a lot of unique situations before. Orlando, Boston, LA, and now Philly. It's interesting, BJ. Yesterday, we recorded with J.J. Redick on All the Smoke, and he was talking about the Philly experience, and him and Matt Barnes were talking about their experience with the Clippers and losing that 2015 series to Houston up 3-1 and then reacting to the Doc news. And they were a bit surprised. And you read all the criticisms and the commentary and his playoff record and blowing 3-1 leads. And, you know, is it Doc's fault that Kawhi Leonard was 1-for-11 from the floor in the fourth quarter of Game 7 against Denver? Or that Paul George was 1-for-7? Like, you tell me, like, the game starts, coaches can only do so much. The guys have to perform. And I always felt like, and this has nothing to do with my bias to the Celtics, but I always knew that Doc Rivers was going to have his guys ready to play. Whether or not that ended up in a win, well, that's why you play the game on the floor. But his guys were always ready to play. So combine that with what you said, getting the Clippers through the Donald Sterling moment in time, and then continuing to, you know, they became a destination. They became a place where big free agents would go. And, you know, now, as we know, building a new arena and creating their own identity in L.A., this timing with the veteran roster, to me, it doesn't make a lot of sense. And to your point about it happening right away, I think Doc's only had 1 year off in the last 20 years. I think he's coached every year. And I just, you know, I just hope he doesn't get to a point where he feels like he's entering burnout mode, because as we know, Philadelphia and the expectations there and comes with it, that's not the same as some other markets in the league. So he obviously went through it in Boston. He went through it in L.A. You know, I can make all the jokes in the world about the Sixers and the Celtics historic rivalry, yeah. But you know, you want to see what's best for Doc. And
you know Doc has been, it's been interesting. You know, Doc has really had an interesting career, because we talk about 3-1. Look, you know, I think this is probably the ex player in me.
Yeah.
And when I've been on good teams, and when I've been on bad teams, all right, why were they bad? I always look at myself and go, you know what? That's where I was at as a player. I was on that team, right? You know, like, mm-hmm. I it's easy for me to say, oh,
you're there for a reason.
Yeah, I've been on bad teams. But where was I at in my career at that particular time, right?
Right.
Later in my career, you know, it's hard to say, but I wasn't the same player later in my career that I was earlier in my career. You know, did I have moments? Yeah, I had a quarter here, maybe a game there, a week here, but it wasn't the consistency that I had earlier in my career. But when you are on a good team, when you are on a great team, one thing that I learned is that those players in that locker room, and that put that uniform on, I ain't worried about the coaches. I just didn't. I really didn't. I can remember running out of the locker room, and the coaches would always say this. I had a coach who would always say this. He was like, "Men, you can't win the game in the locker room."
And there you have it.
And I always took that to heart. Like, it was kind of like, okay, guys, there's nothing going to happen in this locker room. Yeah. We could talk about the great game plans. We could talk about strategy.
Give the speech, you know, really give the speech.
We could walk out of there with the greatest speech. The game can't be won in the locker room. And I took that to heart. When I was on good teams, I didn't care what the game plan was, just to be honest with you. I really didn't. Because every great player and every great person or teammate who's played on a great team understands what I'm saying. I got to find a way to win that game. I got to find a way. I have to find a way. I don't know what's going to happen during that game. But what I do know is that every scenario that I could potentially see that I felt prepared for, and it is my job to figure out how to win that game. Yeah, Phil Jackson may have wanted to substitute me at the 7-minute mark, but you know what? That's not a good matchup versus Magic Johnson, because Magic Johnson just scored 10 straight points. So are you going to coach your game plan, or are you going to coach the game?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what the game is going to, what's going to happen. So
react to the game.
And that's what I learned as a player. Like, you have to take some responsibility. And the reason I'm saying this is, it's easy to point the finger and say, "Doc, that's the easy thing. Oh, Doc was up 3-1. I played against Doc Rivers when he used to could make baskets. He hasn't made a basket since Lord knows how long, you know, same as me. Like, but what I do know is that he had a game plan that if executed, it could have worked, because they were up in every single game that they played in. They were up.
Yep.
So clearly they had the game plan. Clearly something was there. But the most difficult part is you got to go out and execute it. I've seen great game plans and I've lost by 30. I've seen some game plans that I was like, I don't know if that'll work.
And we go out and win by 20.
I've seen a
damn good team on the other side too.
I've played for Hall of Fame coaches, Eric, and I've seen this. I've seen coaches go up, and we've had a whole board full of play calls and all this. I had a coach go up one time, wipe the whole board clear, and said, "We're going to run one play. And whatever play, whoever has it going on the offensive end, we're going to go to that guy." I've never played so hard in my life, Eric, to be hot. Eric. Eric. Oh,
that's great.
Eric. And I was a veteran then. Eric, I never went in warm-ups. Eric, I just prayed that I was hot that night. Because the coach told me.
You got that lather in the pregame. You got it going.
Man, Eric, it was like one of those nights where, you know, another game. It might have been the fourth game in 5 nights. He said, "Whoever is hot, that's what we're going through. This don't mean nothing." Eric, that was the best warm-up I've ever had in my 11 years in the NBA. Every player on the team felt the same way. They was like, "Man, if I get hot, coach is just going to come to me." And we played defense. Eric, we won this game by 30 points. And after the game, he was like, "It's not about these plays, guys. It's about doing what you got to do to get your guys to play hard. And you guys played hard, and that's all I can ask." And yep. Eric, it was like one of those games, Eric, where I'm telling you, I was so fired up for that game, because I just wanted to be hot. I wanted to know. I just wanted him to call my play.
Did you get hot?
I was semi-hot. You know, to get hot, you got to make 3 in a row. I made 2 in a row that game. But I never got 3 in a row.
So are you going to make me like search the records in the box scores?
I can't, because
I would okay, tell so, you.
All right. Well, I'll figure it out.
But here was it was, this is how it was this, after this game. What
after Chicago? After Chicago.
After Chicago.
Okay.
And I'll never forget. We're in the locker room, and coach says, "Hey, whoever gets hot, that's who we're going with." So our offense was, you guys got to figure out how to play. But I'm just going to go to the guy who gets hot.
Were you at home or on the road?
I can't say. But I will say this, though. Eric, I can't say this. It was one of the most unselfish games we ever played in. Because whatever the combination that was on the floor was going to stay on the floor, too.
Hmm.
So if you found something that worked.
Yep.
We worked. And we found this play that worked. I remember the play. We found a matchup that worked. It was one of the more amazing things because, you know, you come to the bench and you're like, man, God, nothing is working tonight. We were all determined to figure out what was going to work. And I remember we found this play that worked. And it was by total accident. He said he wasn't going to call any plays. So the team found a play that worked. And the amazing thing about it, Eric, was we found a matchup that worked. And when we found the matchup, the coaches knew it, all the players knew it, and the five guys on the floor were happy. And I just happened to be on the floor at this particular time.
I can't wait to try to hunt this down.
And
I can't
Eric, wait. We found a play. And well, you know what's funny, though, is we found the play that worked only against one player.
And what's the play? What's the play?
I can't tell you the play. It was a play, but and the ball always reached this certain player. And Eric, it was the greatest 48-minute game. It's one of my top five games. Okay. Because it was complete freestyle, and we played so unselfish because everyone was hoping that this player would guard them. And when I tell you, Eric, it was like at the highest level because everyone was working in unison to make sure that the ball got to the, and seriously, players are amazing because players know, they just know. And I don't know how, Eric, we didn't have no instruction. All we had was one instruction. Like, I'm going to find out who's hot. And out of respect to the other 11 guys, that you're looking around, you're going, okay, somebody's going to get hot tonight. I wish I could have had the film of the warm up, because everyone was working on their game in the warm up.
There is a regional sports network somewhere that has the warm up of that game.
Oh yeah, yeah. So you know, good luck. You got 11 years. You got 11 years. You don't know if it's home or away. But
well, it's after Chicago.
It's in there somewhere.
Somewhere. All right, so let's pivot to the NBA Finals, and we've got a special guest, BJ. Our guest today, Tanya Ganguly from the LA Times. She is having an interesting bubble experience, and instead of me babbling on, let's welcome Tanya to the Pure Hoops Podcast. Tanya, thanks for joining us.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
So paint the picture for us before we get into the Lakers being up 1-0 in the finals and what this has been like from the basketball side. What's your bubble experience been like, and where are you right now?
I was in the bubble for 2 months. I got there July 12th, right after the teams did. And then I was in there for 2 months. I did the seeding games. I did the lead up, the little like mini training camp they had. I was there for the work stoppage when they decided to protest after the Jacob Blake shooting. I was there for the first round and part of the second round. And then I got to go home for a little bit. And that was nice. And I got to eat things that weren't bubble food. And that was also exciting. I didn't have security staring at me everywhere I went. I would have been fine. I would have liked maybe to continue getting tested for COVID every day. That was a bonus that we had in the bubble, but there's There was positive. Also, when I got back to LA was, you know, the neighborhood, it was covered in smoke. So it was a very surreal experience heading home at that point. And you really couldn't, even though you were in the outside world, like so many things are closed right now. So it's been a very weird summer, as you guys, I'm sure, also could attest to. And then I came back, I came back to Orlando a couple of days ago. So I'm back in Orlando. I'm not inside the bubble now. I'm in the second tier where the owners are and some reporters, and I can go to games, which I wanted to do for the finals.
You know, and looking at the experience from a basketball perspective, I mean, it's been interesting, fascinating to watch, knowing what the NBA was prior to COVID. What was the thing that you experienced being in the bubble from a human perspective? Like, what was the one thing that you said, like, was so extraordinary, just being in the bubble and covering the teams and seeing it? Because everyone is dealing with it, whether you are a basketball player, in this case, you're reporting and covering the teams. What was the human perspective that was a shared experience from everyone that's been in this bubble?
Yeah, BJ, I think you said it. It's a there was this like very strange shared experience that as a reporter, you don't always have. You know, I think there are some times when it does feel like, you know, like as you're on the same travel schedule kind of as the teams that you cover, you're staying in the same cities. It's there are a lot of differences. But what happened in the bubble is like everybody was, I mean, we were in the same resort that the top eight teams were in. And so it just was this like crazy experience of, you know, the night that the Jazz got eliminated, like the place that the reporters go to unwind after a game is the same place that the players all walk by you. Like and it's like this, like, oh, what are you going to do when you leave? Like, oh, have fun, you know, nice. Like it's like this kind of interaction that I think used to happen a lot more in our profession. And when players and reporters got to know each other a little better and had that kind of human connection more, and, you know, like they're not even just from a reporter standpoint, like you could be, if you're a coach who got a technical by some ref that you were really mad at, like you could see him the next day at the bar or like having dinner. Like you're just going to run into these people all the time. There was like a really sweet scene that Danny Green described. I keep bringing up the Jazz and Nuggets because I think that was like right about when I left. But he described the scene of Donovan Mitchell and Jamal Murray, like after game seven, together in like a hotel bar, just chatting and showing their respect for each other. Like, you know, I mean, I know people have mixed feelings about that kind of thing between players that are opponents, but like, that's a kind of environment that you just wouldn't have anywhere else. There's eight teams all together, living together for 2 months, 3 months almost.
Definitely a unique environment and culture. And I think it's going to create a lot of bonds for the long term, whether it's, you know, people from the media side and the basketball side, and obviously players that never would have been able to interact in that manner as well. So as far as on the court goes, obviously Lakers and Heat underway. Lakers take a commanding lead in game one. As BJ knows, I was hoping for a Lakers-Celtics finals, but here we are. And, you know, before we get to anything Miami-related, LeBron James always grounds himself in the moment. And it's crazy. He's 2-8 in finals game, 2-8 in finals game ones, excuse me. And game one, obviously, Lakers cruise to a win. What mindset did you get from LeBron with post-game commentary, his body language, things he said? How is he treating this as the Lakers now clearly with more than just a lead 1-0, but obviously with the Miami injuries and how well the Lakers are playing, it seems like a whole lot more.
I think he feels how close he is, and he's just very, like, he does not want to screw this up. Like, that's the sense that I get from him, that he's, you know, like there were times during the game when he felt like his teammates were celebrating too much, too soon. He was very much, we still did a lot of things wrong. There's still a lot of things to fix, you know, not a mode of, not like an attitude of celebration right now. And part of it, he remembers all these times that he failed in the finals, right? Like the first finals, he was talking about that today when the Cavs got swept. And he learns from each of those, but also he remembers hating that feeling. Last night he brought up the game two of the 2011 finals when he said that the game, there was a moment when they were up by like 17 points or something like that. And they thought that this was it. And then all of a sudden they lose the game and then eventually they lose the series. And he just knows like how quickly momentum can change. And even though it's a little, I mean, like you look at what's happening in the series right now, Miami has those two huge injuries and, you know, they just got beat up so badly by the Lakers last night, just in general. It's a little hard to buy into the idea that they are, that, you know, the Lakers are in any kind of danger here, but I think LeBron just doesn't want to take any chances.
You know, when you look at what LeBron James has achieved, and the narrative has always been LeBron James and the Lakers, but I just want to pivot a little bit to Jeannie Buss. This has been a long road for her and moving, taking over, you know, ownership and all of those things. What do you think if the Lakers are to win the finals this year and win the championship, what do you think it would mean to Jeannie Buss and what she's done? I mean, we know with the Buss family, but this clearly now she is the person in charge. What do you think a championship would mean to her at this particular time?
It would be huge for her. You know, she likes to deflect and talk about, oh, no, it's not about me, it's about the players. But I think that if she's, you know, this is very important to her. I started covering the team in 2016, and that was like right in the middle of this playoff drought that they had. Mm-hmm. And it was really hard for her, even at that point, when I think it was only 3 years old, the playoff drought, and then they went three more years without making the playoffs. That had never happened before. She had never experienced that before. And it felt to her, it was very personal because it was about what her dad wanted for that franchise. You know, that was one of the first conversation I ever had with Jeannie Buss. That's what she told me. She said, I want this team to be what my dad wanted for it, which is a great basketball team. And they were not anywhere close to that at that point. That was 2016. That was like September of 2016. So to have been through everything that the franchise has been through for the past 4 years, you know, the drama with her brothers, the hiring Magic, him abruptly resigning, you know, there was so much talk about the dysfunction that they had. And then on a personal level, it's been a really hard year for her. She had her mom die. Then her good friend Kobe Bryant died. And it's, you know, David Stern, she was also very close with. I think it's just been an emotionally trying time this year and several years before this. And I think that it would mean a lot to her for the Lakers to win the championship this year.
Wow, it's been a long year. I can't imagine from her perspective, and it's crazy to think about the different eras of basketball that we've either all watched or participated in, and the Lakers were out of the playoffs for that long of a time. You know, speaking of championship windows, obviously it's right here right now for the Lakers. LeBron's got one more year on the deal, an option for 21-22. He's 4,146 points behind Kareem. What you've seen, what you've observed, what you hear, how long do you think LeBron James is playing NBA basketball?
I feel like he thinks he's got a while left.
Please define a while. I need to know what a while. I mean, he's in year 17. Time doesn't affect him like the rest of us. What does that mean, a while?
I just feel like at least four more years. I don't know. I mean, who knows? But I just feel like he thinks he's got that in him. And, you know, I mean, he would never want to publicly talk about like playing with his son, but there's a time. Yeah. There, like,
yeah.
But yeah,
well, let's do the math too. He turns 40 in his birthday's late December. And he was born in 84. So 2024, he turns 40. That's got to be a target for him, right? Crazy to think about 40 at that level, just casually getting triple doubles at 40 with AD in his prime and his son on the wing.
I do wonder, like, is he the kind, because I feel like there are two different kinds of people when it comes to that conversation. It's like, there are some people who wouldn't want to play if they weren't still the best, right? And then, I don't know, I wonder if that would factor in for him eventually.
You know, Tony, it seemed like there's a huge chemistry that has developed between LeBron and AD. AD is coming up here with his contract here shortly. What do you think the mindset right now of Anthony Davis moving forward? Do you see him making a long-term commitment to the Lakers? Do you see him exploring free agency? I mean, if they win a championship and you look at, let's say LeBron is able to play two or three more years, I mean, do we dare enter or start saying this could be a potential dynasty in the making?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that AD is going to go anywhere. I mean, I think he's really in a place that he enjoys. The relationship with LeBron is so good. Today they were talking about how the jealousy aspect that LeBron said just doesn't exist between the two of them. And that's very genuine. Like, you can see that. And it's clear that that's a big part of why their personalities fit so well together. That like AD doesn't get upset if there's a perception that LeBron is sort of the big brother role, because that's how he sees it. He sees this guy who's won championships and been to 10 finals and has done things that he hasn't done that he wants to do. And so that, I think that's a big part of why their relationship works. And I think he's happy there. Like, I think that this LeBron has been able to give AD the support and like the structure and the frame of reference to understand what it is to win on this level. And I think that's been, they've really helped each other throughout this time. And so I mean, who knows what happens, but like, I do think that they're gonna stay together as long as they can.
Yeah, AD staying in the LeBron window and figuring out the contract is at least from where I sit, a no-brainer. And then obviously the commonalities who's handling their business off the floor, that aligns itself nicely too. So it's crazy. You think about like when LeBron landed with the Lakers, and obviously right away there was chatter, you know, where's Anthony Davis going to go? We know he wants out of New Orleans, but you know, looking at some of the other pieces that they added around them, if you told us 2 years ago that Danny Green, Dwight Howard, Rajon Rondo, JaVale McGee were going to be part of this very reliable and veteran supporting cast and it was all going to work this well, I think we all could have gotten a good laugh out of it, because it's quirky and you never saw some of these guys who always battled against each other coming together, but there's so much collective experience there. What has that experience brought to this team?
Yeah, I think that, you know, Rondo's experience has been really important for them. Danny Green, people talk about less, but he's been huge for them. When I was thinking about, you're seeing those guys that have championship experience be more important as the playoffs have gone on. I mean, when I first was thinking about their team, I was like, well, they expect Kyle Kuzma to be really critical to their championship run. He's never been to the playoffs. KCP is another guy who has played really well and who was really, really important last night. But KCP doesn't have a long playoff history. But then you look at the Rondo, who was not somebody that Rondo, who's somebody that's become a lot more important once they've gotten to this point. Like, that's where you see it be that much more critical. And I think, like, he's someone also that LeBron trusts, and that I think the team trusts to sort of know what's going on all the time and to be able to settle everybody down. So it's been big, but I mean, I think, you know, the two biggest factors, we can talk about the value of the veterans and all of that stuff, but the two biggest factors are obviously LeBron and AD.
Well, for sure. And now, you know, when you look at it, if, you know, it's so difficult to win a championship, and it's so difficult to get, you know, go make a deep playoff run. This season has been unusual, to say the least. Where will you place the difficulty of what these young men and everyone that's been in this situation? Do you, you know, some has called for an asterisk by this. It's not a real championship. I happen to be from the school of, I think this is probably more impressive. Where do you stand with the champion, whoever will be called champion this year? Where do you stand with, in taking in consideration everything that, you know, this season has brought about and what's going on in the world?
Yeah, it's definitely different. I mean, it is, and it definitely is probably harder, but it is also different. So, I mean, I guess it just depends on what you think deserves an asterisk. Like, do you expect every championship? I mean, I guess so if you think about it like this, like, if you want to put an asterisk on something, does that mean that every championship was the same? Is that what the assumption is for that? Because that's not true, right? So, you know, the fact that this particular playing in Orlando in a bubble for 2.5 months, the fact that that has never happened before, I do think that makes it harder. But, you know, people also have brought up that every team went through that. You know, like every team in the bubble had the same experience, and you know, some had it harder than others for because of personal things happening, and that's also how life is. So I mean, just getting through this season was for the Lakers. It's like there wasn't a lot of drama in the interior. Like, from the inside, there wasn't very much drama, mm-hmm. but they just had so many things happening one after another, that, you know, I think that one way or another, this was like a hugely difficult season for them.
Yeah. And I just want to follow up here, and you living out here in LA and myself living out here in LA, and I'm always interested, this is an LA question. So, you know, Eric, you know, I just want you to just kind of listen in on this one. The Clippers, what did this mean? What does this mean? Because for the first time, I felt that there was a real, like, little rivalry going here, you know? There was a, you know, the Clipper fans came out. What do you think this means if the Lakers win a championship, the Clippers losing in the fashion that they lost, what's happened here? What's going on with the Clippers? Like, what's going on in this LA divide between Clipper fans and obviously Laker Nation is, you know, they're cemented. I mean, they're one of the storied franchises ever.
Don't you feel like when the Clippers lost, I felt like there were some people who were like, oh, that's too bad, we don't get the LA series. Mm-hmm. But I feel like Laker fans were like gleeful and like amused, right?
Of course they were.
It was like, I told you. It was like a, yeah.
I mean, I think like this, there's this like, I've heard this, I don't know if this is true or how it could be true or why it would be true. And sorry, it's getting the sunset while I've been talking to you guys. But I don't know why this would be true, but people insist that it's the Clippers as an organization don't know how to win. But it doesn't, what does that have to do with the players right now that are completely new to this team and this organization? So I don't know, but I do think that LA, a city of mostly Laker fans, really enjoyed how the Clippers went out.
Tanya, thank you very much for joining us. Good luck down there the rest of the way. This was great. Stay safe. Stay safe, stay healthy. And hopefully visit with you again soon when we know what next season will bring in the league.
appreciate it.
So, BJ, I mean, every day I still feel like we're living in the twilight zone in some ways, but, you know, this, you know, LeBron James trying to win a title with his third different franchise, obviously quite a journey, but doing it under these circumstances and doing it against the Heat and against Riley, it's just, I feel like I'm in a time warp as we talk about these things and discuss them. I know we've talked Riley before, but what's the one thing that comes rushing back to your mind about your dealings with him before I throw out some just incredible things from his basketball journey?
Well, the first thing is when you think about, you know, Pat Riley's career in the NBA, you know, he's a walking encyclopedia, and he's seen every great player since 1970. And when you talk about information and excellence and how the game has, you know, developed, how the game has continued to grow, Pat Riley has been there, along with, you know, Phil Jackson, for more or less, has been there since 1970. You know, they, you know, when I think of Pat Riley in particular, I say, well, he won as a player, he's won as a coach, he's won as an executive. He's probably been involved in more competitive environments than anyone else, probably maybe in the history of the game. He would, to me, Eric, that's a documentary. I just want to know what every great, he can give you a detail of every great player that has played since
I've thought about it, and it's just simply titled Riley. I mean,
just Riley,
In the 60s, he played in the NCAA championship for Kentucky. In the 70s, he won a title as a player with the Lakers. For those that don't know, Pat Riley was broadcasting at the beginning of the Magic Johnson era, and then all of a sudden he finds himself in an assistant coaching role and then takes over the Lakers in the 81-82 season, goes on to win four titles in the 80s with Showtime. He coaches the Knicks in the 90s, has them moments away from a title. Then he goes to Miami and builds the Heat franchise from an expansion team to now, I mean, it's 25 years in Miami. He's won two titles as team president. Three titles overall as team president. One of those a coach, and now back in the finals now with Spoelstra and everything else brand new. I mean, that's 7 decades of competing at this ultimately high level. And it's just, it's unbelievable to think about how he's been able to go from player to coach to coaching different styles, different greats, different coasts, the triangle of Los Angeles to New York to Miami, and then to build this quote-unquote Heat culture and put this professional franchise, not just on the map, but really define their own excellence in South Florida. It's truly remarkable.
Yeah, he really is. And, you know, you talk about what he did as a player. You talk about what he did as a coach. But I think his crowning achievement is what he's done as an executive. And to watch Coach Spo go from a video executive, video coordinator, to the head coach, and watch and do this under the watch and eye of Pat Riley, and to watch Coach Spo develop into, I think he's a Hall of Fame coach.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And to watch him develop his own personality, develop into his own coach, running his own system, it's been beautiful to watch, because, you know, having a mentor is of absolute necessity when you're talking about reaching excellence. And for him to come in as a young coach, have to coach Hall of Fame players, LeBron James, Dwayne Wade, Chris Bosh, coaching under the scrutiny and the pressure of championship or bust. And
allowing and to watch Pat Riley do that. You know, it's very difficult. You know, we watched Phil Jackson try to accomplish the same thing in New York, which didn't turn out as well. But to watch Pat Riley do this, and, you know, I think Mickey Arison and the ownership down there, they deserve credit as well. But it's been fascinating to watch this level of sustained excellence for so many years. And it's, you know, every time I, you know, have an opportunity to speak with Coach Riley, it's always fun. And one of my fascinating things, or one of my things I look forward to every year when I go to the Chicago Combine, is Coach Riley and I, we always end up staying in the same hotel, and I always try to find out when he's working out for an hour or so, and I can get my hour and a half with Coach Riley. So that's my
you just happen to wander into the gym at the same time.
Always great, and he just gives me, it's like I just get jewels. I just get just gives me jewels. So that's my Coach Riley story. We always kind of laugh about it, because I'm like, when are you coming to work out? And I just wait for him, and he's always kind enough to let me interrupt his workout by I'm just asking him questions. So he's been great for the game, and you know, he's been terrific, and what a career he's had.
That's a good vehicle for a documentary scene. You guys just in there chopping it up, fly on the wall cameras, and it's the workout with Riley. You get all the gems. He picks up his dumbbells, gives you that game face look.
I'm sure he's like, I wish this guy would shut up. He's like, not you again. I'm sure he's saying that.
You know, last week when we had, and it's safe to say at this point, Ethan Skolnick is most definitely a Miami Heat historian, and obviously gave us great stuff. You know, you think about Spoelstra's first season with LeBron and Wade and Bosch, and they start 9-8, and, you know, they're having the pep rally and the celebration before the year, and then, you know, they struggle out of the gate because there were high expectations and all the hype. And you know, Riley in the past, he made a move where he fired Stan Van Gundy. He took the team over himself and led him to the title in 06 with a young Dwayne Wade and Shaq and that team. And I would love to know what his instincts were telling him about who Eric Spoelstra could be in the long run as a head coach, because what he's developed into and just how impressive he continues to be is incredible. And let's make something clear. Like, this Spoelstra respect thing has been going on for a while, but the fact now that they've made this improbable run by many to the finals, he's getting a lot of that shine. But he's been doing a heck of a job, especially since LeBron James left after 2014. So that's something I would love to know. So the next time you're working out with Riley, just get me on speakerphone or record the convo or do whatever you got to do, because I want to know what that thing was
about
that he saw. Not just the work ethic. You know, Spo was a grinder. Anybody who's willing to work like that in the video room to get where they want to go, you know, they've got work ethic. But what were those other intangibles? That's what I'm curious about.
Well, you know? I mean, I could take a good guess, and you know, in watching. When you achieve a level of success, and you know, you've heard players say it, and I kind of learned it. You know, when you win a championship, you know, the difficult thing of repeating is that what you did last year, you find out it's not going to work the following year, because everyone is catching up to the style of play or what you did last year to counter that. And right. These executives and these players, they learn very quickly. And I think it was, you know, Steve Kerr who said, it's not that we're getting worse as a team. It's just these teams around the league are improving and catching on to what we're doing and how we play. Small ball, right? And the reason I bring that up is the one thing about Coach Spo, which I think is fascinating in his journey, is there's no substitute for experience. And one of my greatest growth as a player and as an executive is having the ability to watch tape and watch and learn, and not just watch
because I played, not just watch because, you know, I have a title or a fancy title, but you have to watch and understand the game. Learning how to watch tape. When I learned how to watch tape, you know, I had a coach that I played for, Tex Winters. Tex Winters was the first coach who taught me specifically and technically how to watch game film, not to watch what I did wrong, but to watch the concept of the game and understand the game itself. It was a fascinating journey for me because I would watch and be like, oh man, look at that guy. He, you know, that nice move or what have you. I began to truly understand the game. I truly began to understand sets. I truly began to understand concepts. And watching video gives you a significant advantage because you no longer watch the game from a fan's perspective. You're no longer emotionally attached to the game. You're just watching technically, and you're watching for the facts of the game. Pat Riley understands the game at an elite level. That's very clear when you have a conversation with him. He never gives you his opinion. You can have a two-hour conversation, and he never gives you his opinion. He'll tell you specifically why this guy is a great player. He'll tell you exactly the system that's needed to win in this scenario. And when I watch his teams, and when I watch this team now, Pat Riley is unquestionable. He went from Showtime to having one of the most physical teams ever when I played against that team in New York. Then he goes down there and coaches in Miami. He figures out how to integrate this young athletic player, Dwayne Wade. And then to watch Coach Spo do it in his own way, Pat Riley truly understands the game. He's not just saying, like so many coaches, like I thought it was interesting when Coach Jackson came. It's not criticizing Coach Jackson, Phil Jackson, when he came to New York, but he was very persistent on the triangle offense as a way to play. And
not with that roster.
It's just, you have your beliefs. Pat Riley believes in one thing, winning. Now, there's a million ways to win. And you've seen him adapt to all of these different styles, right? Whether he's had point guards, big guys, wing players, big threes, draft.
Yep.
He's figured it out. So I think, you know, it's just a tribute to his true understanding of people, first of all, and the game itself. You know, he's not a coach. He's a true master. You know, he's a true master of the game. And every time I talk to him, I come away with like, okay, I have to continue to grow because his, you know, when you speak with him, I mean, you're talking to literally, I mean, he's like, we need to get this done, Eric. I mean, this is our project now. We have to get a documentary.
It's playing in my mind. I mean, it's literally playing in my mind.
I can only imagine. He could talk about every player.
Well, and just the differing eras of the style, what was going on in the business of the game, how you manage personnel, how you manage people, how you build bonds, what you learn from your mistakes. There's so much there. But to go from, you know, to go from Kareem outlet to Magic to Worthy slam dunk to, you know, Starks, Oakley, Ewing, street fight. And obviously so many people over the years, when they talk about Riley, they talk about that. That's the core of Pat Riley, that mentality, I mean, that, you know, Schenectady, upstate New York fighter, competitor. He just wore that Showtime persona.
I mean, he's seen Pat Riley has seen Jerry West up close, Elgin Baylor
up close, Wilt Chamberlain
up close. He coached Kareem. Okay. He's coached Shaq. He's coached Magic.
Worthy.
He's worked with like LeBron, Dwayne Wade,
Patrick Ewing. I mean, just to name a few. He's seen every great player that has come through since 1970. I just want to hear who he thinks is the perhaps the great. Now he have the authority. He would have the authority to like his opinion would matter.
In that conversation, I mean, you've got two Bill of the guys Russell. Over, your, over your shoulders. Yeah.
Right.
I mean, you've got Wilton Kareem there and Russell out of frame. I mean, Riley's one of the guys that's seen it all. And he, I think, also can frame up, no pun intended for your jerseys, but he can really frame up what defines the eras and how you know, it's so hard, and we've been through this so many times, and then obviously everything around The Last Dance and the MJ LeBron talk, and it's so hard to compare the players and the eras. It's a fun exercise. What, you know, where I check out is when, you know, people are telling other people their opinions are wrong, which is crazy, but you've got to come to the table with the right information and the right stuff, and I can't imagine how Riley would lay all of this out, and then obviously... you know, Riley being such a central figure in Lakers Celtics in the 80s is just the convo around that would be mind blowing, and how that impacts how the game has grown, evolved, and succeeding today is something too. So I think we just laid out at least the groundwork for us getting some stuff on paper. So let's do it. Let's put this on paper. I know attempts have been made before to work with him, but we haven't seen anything that's come out. So let's do some homework. And for those of you listening that think you're going to steal BJ and I's idea, good luck. Good luck. But this was great today, my friend. Good to dig in. Lots happening in and out of the bubble. And, you know, I miss being dropped off at your office, waiting for you in the lobby to do and show a show in person.
We'll be back in no time. I feel it's coming back. All right, we're sending the positive vibes out here.
Definitely. So we will be back next week. Hopefully, we'll still be in finals mode. We'll see what Miami can come up with here, despite these injuries and the Lakers on a roll. So. Time will tell, but I hope everybody has a healthy and safe weekend. Special thanks, as always, to producer Mike Lieber, the one and only Bruce Bernstein, editor Tom Phillip, and the entire Pure Hoops Media team. The Mike Wise Show drops each Monday. John Fanta talks college basketball every Tuesday with Full Court Press. Catch and Shoot 2.0 with Aaron Berlin and Otto Strong drops each Wednesday. Monica McNutt, King McClure bring you Buckets, Boards, and Blocks Thursdays. And Fridays, it's the Pure Hoops Podcast with BJ Armstrong and myself, Eric Newman. Please check out all of our shows. Subscribe, download, rate, review. Share them with your crew. Most of all, enjoy. We'll see you next week on the Pure Hoops Podcast. Stay safe, stay healthy, stay pure. Peace.
The Pure Hoops Podcast is a presentation of Pure Hoops Media.